This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Lots to talk about this hour. Some alarming details emerging from the violent attack at the shopping mall in Kenya. We're going to also give you a preview of the stalemates to come in Congress that could put the brakes on an economic recovery. We'll talk about why some unions might want to put the brakes on the Affordable Care Act. And we'll have a guide for how to ban books in free speech America, all perfectly legal, coming up later this hour. But we begin with an exploration of radicalism in Nairobi, still the scene of violence and a battle between the terrorist group Al-Shabaab and the Kenyan military. The violent, chaotic situation at the Westgate Shopping Center is beginning to yield some details about who Al-Shabaab's apparently suicidal militants actually are, what their new leadership might want, and whether the international community was lulled into a sense of false security about this Somali-based militant group because of some perceived military setbacks on the ground in Somalia and elsewhere in East Africa. Joining us is Jendaya Fraser, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She's currently a distinguished public service professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
It's great to talk to you again. There's been a leadership shift in Al-Shabaab. That's been well documented. And that was going on sort of while you were still in government, yes?
Yeah, the first leadership of Shabaab, particularly, you know, the very militant extremist segments, was really East Africa Al-Qaeda cell. And you had people like Fazul Muhammad, Aidan Aro, and others who were part of the East Africa Al-Qaeda cell who essentially, I would say, hijacked Shabaab and turned it more into a global jihadist organization. It's certainly a group that has always been on the run and has accordingly changed its tactics according to the circumstances on the ground. You know, they had originally talked about trying to govern and create a Sharia state in Somalia, and they can't accomplish that goal. It's very clear, particularly with the African Union forces in there.
To defeating them on the battlefield and setbacks politically in Somalia, they have no quarter there.
They do not. And also their own ideology and their own viciousness. During the 2011 famine, they were actually denying food assistance to the population, and so they don't have popular support. And they are on the run militarily, but they will evolve their tactics. And so I don't think we've seen the last of Al-Shabaab. And it's not difficult, frankly, in many ways to attack, right? It's some people have said, you know, sound governments, democratic governments have to be 100%, whereas these terrorists only have to make one successful strike and make it spectacular to give the sense that they are really on the ascendance. I'm not so sure that that's the case with Shabaab.
Although that analysis tends to get the international community off the hook. I mean, didn't somebody drop the ball here on not being vigilant about the possibility of an attack like this?
Well, no, I do think that the United States, and I have to give President Obama and his administration credit for this, have been certainly doubling down on George Bush's strategy in Somalia, working very closely with the regional leaders, the Ugandans in particular, Kenya since 2011, carrying out this fight and supporting them with intelligence, supporting them with equipment. I do think that that's to their credit. I think where they made mistakes is the business of Kenya and its post-election and the ICC, where they haven't embraced Kenya the way they should. You know, Kenya hosts a number of Somalis in its capital city, and you have refugee populations that are coming across. And so the insecurity coming out of Somalia has been a challenge for the entire region and most certainly for Kenya.
Well, as far as hosting Somali refugees or immigrants is concerned, the U.S. possibly has something to answer for. Last night, Kenyan Foreign Minister Amina Mohamed spoke to the PBS NewsHour about possible British and American involvement in the attack. Listen.
From the information that we have, two or three Americans, and I think so far I've heard of one Brit.
And the Brit was a British-born woman?
Woman. And she's, I think, done this many times before.
And the Americans?
The Americans, from the information we have, are young men. Mm-hmm. Between maybe 18 and 19.
Of Somali origin?
Of Somali origin or Arab origin. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, lived in the U.S., in Minnesota and one other place. You know, so basically, look, I mean, that just goes to underline, I think, the global nature of this war that we're fighting.
It's Kenyan Foreign Minister Amina Mohamed in an interview with the PBS NewsHour. Now, that could all be wrong. all that information is unconfirmed, but it's certainly alarming. Is there a Tsarnaev scenario here of a radicalization that took place in the United States? Does the U.S. even watch Somali immigrants as targets of other countries, only concerned with if they're targeting the United States?
Well, no, I think that the FBI in particular has been following leads about recruitment of young men, particularly, Somali origin, but basically American citizens, some of them surely born in the United States, who are being recruited to participate in global jihad, including in Somalia. And so I think that the U.S. government has been watching this, and our intelligence services and our FBI are on top of it.
The nuance here. You say we've been watching it. Does that mean that from your perspective in the U.S. government that we have considered this a problem, recruitment by al-Shabaab of Americans? We have considered that a problem already?
For many years. For many, many years, we've considered it a problem. There was an attack in Mogadishu on an outpost that was basically an intel cell. And those were an American suicide bomber of Somali origin there. So we have been watching the recruitment. The U.S. government, I'm not in the government today, but the U.S. government, even when I was Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, the FBI was following leads in the United States of recruiting here.
Final thoughts. I mentioned Tsarnaev's radicalization, the Boston Marathon bombing. Is there something, possibly a potential failure of culture in the United States, that people can be isolated, alienated, and radicalized by just being sort of rogue outliers in communities of immigrants in the United States?
Well, I think we may overanalyze that. Certainly there's issues about assimilation of communities, but even assimilated communities can go on jihad if they're radicalized or they take on an ideology. And young people are often disaffected of any origin, of any nationality, of any race. A lot of them just feel alienated just because of the point in their life. I think young people are subject to, I guess you could say, programming in some ways, or giving ideological training.
And again, the details unclear, unconfirmed. We're going to learn a lot more about the nature of these attackers. Jendaiah Frazier, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Jendaiah Frazier is former U.S. Secretary of State for African Affairs, currently a distinguished public service professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Let's look now at a city of legend and diversity in East Africa, Nairobi, a metropolis of fear right now.
I'm very worried, and we feel very insecure because I've gone to places like the supermarkets. Nakumat is all closed. I went even to a bank, and I couldn't get money. It's closed.
Terrified Nairobi resident Jemima Ndiza, a resident speaking to China Central Television. What is symbolic about Nairobi, and what in its proud history would attract the likes of al-Shabaab? Mwangi Skamenyi is a senior fellow and director of the Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution, currently serves as advisory board member of the School of Economics at the University of Nairobi. Mwangi Skamenyi, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Why is Nairobi such a symbol? Is it like New York, like Beirut, like Paris and London in Europe?
I think Nairobi, when you think about the East African coast, actually East and Central Africa, when you look at South Africa all the way to Cairo, I think Nairobi, or at least Kenya, Nairobi is the most important city in that region. So the East African region, the Horn of Africa, is a very diverse city. It's an international city, modern city, but also with different types of neighborhoods, different types of people. So it's a very unique city and an important center. It's the most. It's a commercial center also. So it's a very important city for the region.
With a huge United Nations installation, with a large CIA installation, we understand, with the big commercial sector.
I don't know
sector.
About the CIA.
Right.
I know about the UN. We have a large international business centers. I mean, there are a lot of companies that are headquartered in Nairobi, and you have a lot of also regional companies that are also headquartered there. So in terms of both international activities. There are so many international organizations and also businesses. Nairobi is quite is probably the most. I think it's after Johannesburg. It's the other important city within the East African that part of the continent.
How demoralizing and heartbreaking is an attack like this, since it seems to go after every sector of the society in some way?
This is a very sad situation for the country, particularly because Kenya has been a very good host. It's hosted a lot of people. It's the country that you get a lot of refugees coming to. It hosts a lot of the Somali refugees from the long unstable period. So the Kenyans do feel demoralized that they are paying a very high price for being good hosts. But they have also recovered. They have faced a lot of these type of incidents now and then. But Kenyans are also, it also brings them together. They work together. So they are demoralized, but they will also come even stronger.
What is the chance that this inflames anger, ethnic, inter-ethnic anger between the people of Kenya and other people in East Africa, across the border in Somalia, in Ethiopia, in Eritrea?
Well, I would hope that it doesn't happen. I think Kenyans do realize that it's true that you may have some of these militant groups, some of them coming from Somalia. But we also have a very large Somali population that's Kenyan and is peaceful. And I don't expect that they would react irrationally, attacking other people. I would expect that Kenyans are going to realize that this is a few elements, and there is not something to be generalized. And they are not going to retaliate against innocent people, because it will be like the same people who attacked innocent people at the mall.
It's a small world, and raising arms harms everyone in the community. Mwangi Kamenya is a senior fellow and director of the Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution. He currently serves as an advisory board member of the School of Economics at the University of Nairobi. Knows the city very well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I don't know if you looked at your calendar. The American Library Association calls the third week in September Banned Book Week. In the United States, you could fill a small library with books banned somewhere in the U.S. What books have been banned in your community, at your child's school or library? Here's a text from Worcester, Massachusetts. I recall growing up in Dakar, Senegal, and all schools banned the Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie. It was such a big deal in the country, which is about 95% Muslim. Such writing was found to be very offensive to the community, so I do agree with the decision to ban the book. No matter what it is, writings should never offend anybody at any time, anyhow. Later this hour, we're going to talk with parents, school board officials, and librarians about the process of banning books here in the United States. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway. From WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's not exactly down to the wire for the U.S. government, but House Republicans this week get to take their war against the Affordable Care Act to the U.S. Senate. Tomorrow, the Senate will take its first vote on that continuing resolution that ties funding for the government to the postponement of ACA.
The ransom demanded by House Republicans in exchange for keeping the government open is unworkable and unrealistic.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid there. You may have gathered the Senate will vote no on the measure, which the Wall Street Journal today basically called political suicide for House Republicans in an editorial. Quote, we wish the GOP luck since we support the policy, if not the strategy. But however this charge into the fixed bayonets turns out, we hope the folks who planned it will take responsibility for what happens now. Joining me is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
You know, this editorial in the Journal goes on. We've lost this debate, they say in the Journal, and Generals Cruz and Lee are in charge. Who are they referring to there?
That's Senator Mike Lee of Utah and Ted Cruz of Texas who are leading the charge on this.
And the Journal says, if they do succeed and defund Obamacare, we, the Wall Street Journal, gladly give them due credit. But if things don't go well, let's not hear any excuses about the surrender caucus or claims that would all have worked out if only everyone were as brave and principled as the generals up at HQ. Is there a war in the GOP, Todd?
Oh, there certainly is, and there has been for weeks. We've mentioned it on this show, and the Wall Street Journal chiming in, and not for the first time, by the way, with the notes that you just sounded there, John, only point up what this has become, which is Republican on Republican crime. Warnings for weeks and even months. We played a cut on this show, John, about 2 months ago of Senator Richard Burr, conservative Republican from North Carolina, asked, what about using the CR to defund Obamacare, saying it's the stupidest idea I've ever heard? Not because he supports Obamacare, but he knew they couldn't win. Now Ted Cruz and Mike Lee are out in front of the Senate, and you see the Wall Street Journal, they're saying what a lot of Republicans have said all along. Now, it got a little bit worse yesterday for Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, and I say worse, but it might not necessarily be bad for them at all, and we'll get to that. Yesterday, from behind the scenes, as Ted Cruz was battling Harry Reid a little bit rhetorically over this strategy of using a government shutdown or the threat thereof to defund Obamacare, very quietly, with statements, two senators, two important senators. First, Senator John Cornyn, who is Ted Cruz's Texas colleague, saying that he's not going to sign up for Ted Cruz's strategy. He's going to vote against Ted Cruz on this. And Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell also voting against Ted Cruz on this. Again, both saying not because they support Obamacare, but because the strategy can't win, they don't have the votes, is essentially what they're saying. The McConnell case is really interesting because Mitch McConnell is the epitome of this fight in one senator. He's the establishment Republican and the Senate Minority Leader who wants to be Senate Majority Leader if Republicans can take over the Senate in 2014, but he's also got a challenge from his right down there in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Up for re-election and has a Tea Party challenger walking that fine line. And which side of the fine line did he fall on? Not Ted Cruz's side.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. This is The Takeaway. So Todd, maybe Mitch McConnell just and some of the other senators there, Republican senators, are not interested in being a part of Ted Cruz's presidential campaign since he's aiming this message way beyond this fight right now.
And he is. That is exactly right. By all accounts, Ted Cruz would like to run for president. We don't know if he's going to run for president. But this week, and the Senate may not reach a final vote until Sunday. And that part is interesting, John, because what's going to happen here is the Senate is likely to strip out this Obamacare defunding and send a bill back to the House that just has 2 or 3 months of government funding. It is going to be up to John Boehner very, very quickly to make a decision about how to pass a measure that President Obama will sign to avoid a government shutdown. In the meantime, there's going to be a lot of floor time that Ted Cruz and Mike Lee get on the Senate floor under the rules to make speeches, to rail against Obamacare, to rail against lily-livered Republicans,
and
soft
this
Republicans.
Helps C-SPAN? Who does
this
help?
This helps Ted Cruz. This helps Ted Cruz's profile among conservatives. This helps his fundraising. This helps his speeches. He does believe Obamacare should be repealed, and he does believe this is the right strategy, but this does also help his profile. Now, there's a lot of talk, and I want to clarify something here. There's a great deal of talk going around about how Ted Cruz is going to spend this week filibustering this bill, and he's burnishing his credentials in that way. He's actually probably not going to get the chance. Now, he is going to spend a lot of time out there on the Senate floor, but Ted Cruz actually probably won't have the votes from his own Republicans to mount that Rand Paul, Jimmy Stewart talking filibuster kind that we've sort of seen in history where you're out there.
Sure.
Yeah, he's not going to get the chance because he actually needs 41 Republicans to vote with him to block cloture. He's not going to have it. Mitch McConnell's not with him. John Cornyn's not with him. Certainly John McCain isn't. Richard Burr won't be, and a number of other senators. So the idea of actually the hero Ted Cruz filibustering this bill is a myth. However, he is going to get hours and hours and hours out there on the Senate floor to be the hero to the right against President Obama and the Republican establishment.
All right. So quickly, Todd, before we go, when this gets back into the House, is the GOP going to feel pressure to basically pass something? I mean, are they under the gun, or did they then bounce this back to the Senate one more time?
the old John Boehner dilemma in stark relief, a bill that funds the government at a level that Republicans will like, actually, because it locks in sequester levels and gives John Boehner and Republicans a win. However, it won't defund Obamacare. How many Republicans will he get to vote with him? Not enough to pass the bill. He'll have to turn to Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer for lots of Democratic votes to pass the CR. If he doesn't want to take the political risk of relying on Democrats to pass this bill, then he's going to have to go to the mat and risk a shutdown for a few days to negotiate another round. I think it's unlikely that he does that, but we'll have to see. And don't forget the debt limit fight follows.
Oh, yes.
He might live to fight another day.
Oh, yes. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
The President of the United States and the President of Iran speak today at the United Nations General Assembly amidst a mood of conciliation and anticipation that some U.S.-Iran dialogue might emerge. But some in the U.S. don't want to party over improved relations with Iran to drown out calls for justice for people being held prisoner in Iranian jails. American Amir Hekmati, a Michigan resident, was arrested in 2011 by Iranian authorities while on a trip to visit his grandmother. He's been charged with espionage and at one time sentenced to death. The sentence has been overturned. He's now awaiting a trial. With me in studio now is Congressman Dan Kildee, a Democrat from Michigan's 5th District. Welcome. You're something of a champion of Mr. Hekmati.
Yes, he's a constituent of mine. His family lives very nearby. And since I've been in Congress, we've been working to try to free Amir.
Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, he's a 30-year-old former Marine. Was born in Arizona, grew up in my hometown of Flint, Michigan. And recently, 2 years ago, went to visit his ailing grandmother in Tehran. He is of Iranian descent. And he went to visit. And while he was there, he was just there for a short time. He was arrested and subsequently tried and convicted. But he's sort of a typical American story. Worked hard, joined the Marine Corps, served well, and was off meeting his grandmother for the first time. And this is what happened.
Not to excuse the behavior of Iran in any sense, but many Iranians who left in '79 talk with a lot of fear about going back. The idea that if they did go back for whatever reason, that they would encounter the authorities in one case or another. Do you think Mr. Hekmati was taking a risk?
Well, obviously he took more risk than he expected. You know, he was a 20-something former Marine, probably felt like he was unstoppable and wanted to see his grandmother. But with his background, the fact that he is a Marine, that he speaks Farsi, from the Iranian standpoint, it was really a case of circumstantial evidence. Unfortunately, that's really all they had.
UN Ambassador Samantha Power tweeted about Amir Hekmati this week. What sense do you have that the Obama administration is working hard to get him released?
Well, we've been in contact with the State Department, and we're confident if the opportunity arises that they will raise Mr. Hekmati's case with the Iranians. Obviously, we have no direct relationship. So, having Secretary Kerry make a public statement some time ago and now Ambassador Power tweet that Amir should be released. It was in the wake of the 11 that were released. You know, we see it as a good sign.
Maybe a direct relationship would help this, opposed to he's got to be released before there's a direct relationship.
Right. I hope so. I think, the fact that Secretary Kerry is meeting with the Iranian foreign minister here in New York in the coming days is a positive sign. We do have to, proceed with some trepidation. There have been situations in the past where what the Iranian government has said has not come to pass. But with President Rouhani's overtures to the international community, we feel as though if there is a tangible step that could be offered, that might prove the seriousness of the Iranian government in actually trying to reach out to the international community.
What's your chance of an actual Rouhani sighting while you're here in New York?
Well, not very likely. We were at the UN yesterday. I have to go back to Washington. We've got this other battle brewing there that starts tomorrow. So
yeah,
I'll be heading back. But, we have had, some interaction with folks that are close to the Iranian government, and we think that the message is getting through. The social media campaign that we've had out there with 70 members of Congress with the hashtag Free Amir signs being held has really gotten a lot of attention. We know the Iranians pay attention to social media. And so in some way, that's as important as the direct face-to-face communication, because the Iranian government, President Rouhani, will see that the American people are paying attention to Amir Hikmati's case.
Congressman Dan Kildee, Democrat from the 5th District of Michigan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
To try and actually learn something about Iran, free of the ideology and accusatory history of the axis of evil era we all live in right now, how do you do that? Well, just look at Amazon for books on Iran, for instance. Dozens and dozens about war and politics and escapes from Iran, CIA coups. You really have to dig to find first the ancient history of Persepolis, the ancient Persian poetry of Ferdowsi, Nizami and Hafiz, much of which is learned by nearly every Iranian school kid. And one of my favorite books about Iran is The Mantle of the Prophet by Roy Mohedi, which was written back in the 1980s. With us is Kamin Mohammadi, an Iranian-born writer who lives in Italy today. Her memoir, The Cypress Tree, A Love Letter to Iran, is really all about trying to convey the real life of Iran. Kamin, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
How hard is it to explain to people what Iran is really like, taking into account its modern history?
The image that we get of Iran on our television screens and through our newspapers is so different to really what the country is like. You know, we're constantly hearing about the nuclear issue. We're constantly hearing about the government, the regime, the repression, the rights of women, you know, or the lack of rights of women. And what we really don't get to see is the real everyday life of a country which, you know, has a really ancient and beautiful culture.
The seasons now in Iran, I've spent some time there this time of year, actually maybe a few months from now. The snow starts to fall on the mountains. The air gets a little chill in it. And you can smell that unbelievable chicken that they make in Tehran. And it brings it all back to me. What kind of memories do you have?
Oh, well, you've just named, you know, some of the best ones. I mean, I grew up in Tehran, so what I remember is those cold winters with the snow when they would close the schools, you know, and we'd ring our cousins and say, the world is closed, let's go and have snowball fights. And, you know, a few years ago when I was last in Iran, we were driving back from a family dinner, and we were on one of the big highways that crisscrossed Tehran, and the traffic stopped still because there was a heavy snowfall. And you know what happened? Everyone just left their cars and they went into the center of the highway and just started having a big snowball fight.
That's amazing. Tell us a little bit about the geography.
You know, Iran is such a diverse country, and we have, it's also a massive country, right? And it's not just desert, which I guess is perhaps what some people think. We have two amazingly large mountain ranges, one to the north of Tehran and one that sort of goes down the middle of the country to the west. And then, of course, you have the area around the Shatt al-Arab, where I was born, towards the border with Iraq, there to the west and to the south, which is much more humid and hot and desertified. You have the Persian Gulf to the south, absolutely beautiful, crystal clear water. And the other area that I have roots, which is Kurdistan, Iranian Kurdistan, which again is chains of mountains, absolutely beautiful remote villages built on terraces, you know, so that the garden of one is the rooftop of the house under, you know, absolutely stunning. So we have a lot of diversity there, and we have a lot of different ethnicities who all live in Iran, who all consider themselves Iranian, but who anyway have their own distinct language often, and customs and cuisine and traditions and dress. It's a very rich culture.
Finally, before we go, we wanted to give people a sense of what books you might suggest for people besides your own, The Cypress Tree, A Love Letter to Iran, to learn and to feel some of these same kinds of images and memories.
You know, a book that I actually really love, I suppose it's similar to mine, but it's presented in such an engaging way, is Marjan Satrapi's two books, Persepolis, Persepolis 1 and Persepolis 2, which are graphic novels, let's say. They're, you know, they're cartoon strips. You know, the revolution told from a sort of eight-year-old child's point of view, but drawn in such a wonderfully witty way and presented, you know, with such a light touch, even though it's very poignant. And she just gives you an opportunity constantly to laugh at the absurdity of what's happening, as well as sort of reel from the horror. So I really love her book.
Great suggestion. And there's a movie of it as well. Kamen Mohammadi, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
Kamen Mohammadi is a journalist and author of The Cypress Tree, A Love Letter to Iran, a memoir about growing up in that country. So one of the radical changes in the Affordable Care Act is how benefit programs, some benefit programs anyway, health care plans, particularly the most coveted ones, are viewed as income by the federal government and suddenly subject to taxation. Benefit programs are worth a lot. Companies attract employees with them. Unions attract members with their gold standard union plans. But taxing them? This is not popular with unions, who lobbied against the provision in the original law and have gone to court to keep the Obamacare law from being implemented. If the Affordable Care Act is not fixed and it destroys the health and welfare funds that we have fought for and stand for, then I believe it needs to be repealed. We don't want it to be repealed. We want it fixed, fixed, fixed. Those are the words of union leader Terrence O'Sullivan, president of the Laborers International Union of North America, at the AFL-CIO's convention earlier this month. Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace reporter for our partner, The New York Times, joins us now. Welcome, Stephen.
Nice to be here.
So is there a wedge between the Obama administration and unions on this particular point of taxation?
Yes and no, John. Unions were probably the biggest and earliest supporters of Obamacare. They were pushing for something even more generous, either, you know, universal health coverage, as in Canada, single payer, or a public option. And they agreed to Obamacare because it was a major, major step to providing universal health coverage. But unions, when they look at the, you know, fine print, are seeing that as the new health exchanges are set up over the next few months, they worry that some unionized employers are going to stop providing coverage to lower wage union members, and that this is going to be a real pain to these workers. And the unions are worried that this is going to end up decimating some unionized health plans. That's why Terry O'Sullivan said, you got to fix it, or else repeal it.
What's the issue that's of most concern to the unions? Is it the consideration of benefits as income and therefore subject to taxation? Or is it the option of employers to toss people off the rolls and therefore reduce the benefits of union membership?
There are several things, John. One is the worry that employers are going to throw people off the rolls. The employers say, why should we continue providing coverage when workers can get it through the exchange? And the employers might spend $6,000, $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 in providing coverage per worker, and they could face only a $2,000 fine if they stop providing coverage to workers. So the union just saying that $2,000 fine is way too low. It should be higher in order to deter, dissuade employers from doing that. The unions are also saying, if you're subsidizing all these other workers with tax credits to obtain insurance, why don't you do the same for unionized workers as a way to discourage the employers from dumping people off the health plans? And the Obama administration is saying, we don't provide these tax credits, these subsidies, to any other workers who are afforded good health plans. So why should we do that for unions?
So if you're working for, you know, a company and are in a senior management position and have one of these fabulous health care plans, does the Affordable Care Act look at that differently from the way they would look at a specifically union plan tied to a labor union?
John, there is a provision called the Cadillac tax, which I'm sure listeners have heard of. And that means that in 2018, there will be a penalty of 40% of the value of a health plan if the cost of the health plan is over $27,500. And that is true for some executives. Right now, a generous union health plan might spend $18,000, $17,000, $19,000 per worker. It's a question whether it will reach $27,500 for a family plan in 2018. A lot of employers, including the city of New York, are telling unions, your health plan is too expensive. We're worried it's going to hit this $27,500 mark in 2018. And they're trying to, you know, take away things from the plan, make the plan more expensive, increase deductibles, increase copays to discourage in ways workers from using more health resources as a way to hold down the price. And the unions say, that's not fair. This Cadillac tax is backfiring for us. It's causing employers to make us pay more for our plan. It's causing employers to make our plans worse.
With all due respect to the issue of fairness that you raised, though, I mean, haven't the unions been here before? I mean, with corporations and airlines and, you know, the auto industry, they've gotten into enormous trouble with the cost of pension plans and other benefit programs that just suddenly increase exponentially. And when the economy turns downward, the unions have to basically retrench.
Well, you know, pensions can be very expensive. You're absolutely right, John. And when the stock market goes down, as happened in spades in 2007 and 8, then companies realize that they just didn't have enough in their pension plans to pay what they promised to pay out 10 years and 20 years from now. So then they realize, you know, gosh, we owe tens of millions of dollars more to make our pension plans whole. And they said, we want out of pension plans. It just cost us too much. So, you know, for decades, a lot of employers thought pension plans were good, sane things to keep employees, provide them a nice benefit. But in the last 10, 15 years, employers said they're just too darn expensive. We want to, you know, shift the burden, the risk of retirement security to workers rather than have a company absorb that. So they've adopted 401k plans rather than traditional pension plans. And I think, as many of your listeners know, John, 401ks generally don't work nearly as well as traditional pensions. And the employee very much feels the risk, as many workers felt when the stock market dived
right.
in 2007,
Just
2008.
To talk to the 401ks at Enron, that's for sure. Stephen Greenhouse, thanks so much.
Nice to be here, John.
Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace reporter for our partner, the New York Times, talking about the Affordable Care Act and the new reality for benefit programs for union members. So all you free Americans out there, get out your First Amendment and read along with me. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Did you get that? The First Amendment protects freedom of speech. But note, it says Congress shall make no law, etc., etc., etc. In a free America, people are free to do what they like. And that means in the land of free speech, there is considerable energy, perhaps more than you might think, devoted to the banning of books. The American Library Association has even declared the third week in September Banned Books Week. There are dozens of books banned in schools and libraries somewhere in the United States in 2013, including the Quran, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, The Diary of Anne Frank, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, Sarah Grun's Water for Elephants. I could go on. For political reasons, because of alleged profanity, or because of perceived religious blasphemy, books in America can and have been banned since the founding of the nation. This is not a huge issue for the United States. Book banning is rare, but our look at this story is very simple today. Here's how it's done. How to ban a book in free speech America. You start with someone like lawyer Mike Holtzknecht, who's a parent in Stockton, Missouri. Mike, now the book you have a problem with is
The Absolutely True Diary. This is the latest book that caused a stir in our community. Absolutely something about American Indian.
It's a Sherman Alexie's book, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's been banned in a number of communities around the United States. Now, how did you hear about the problem? How did you encounter the book and decide to take some action?
Well, as the former district attorney out here, I had had some involvement, and as a parent, I had some involvement with a book when our son was in the fourth grade that discussed smoking marijuana and obviously age-inappropriate material. And I found out through our local school board the procedure to challenge a book that was in the school, whether a classroom or the library. And it was as simple as filling out a form, the name of the book, the teacher's class, and then the school board would conduct an investigation and make a decision as to whether that book was appropriate or not and whether it should be used in the classroom or kept in the library.
Well, you always want a lawyer involved. Mike, hold on there for a second. So from the parents and outraged citizens who have a problem with the book, you then take your grievance, as Mike did, to the school board. Sarah Pacheco is the public information officer for the Sierra Vista Unified School District. Now, you're currently considering taking a book off the shelves, not the Sherman Alexie books. What is the book you're considering?
It's called Dreaming in Cuban by Christina Garcia.
And where does the process stand? You've already heard from the parents. They filled out the forms, right?
Yes, in Sierra Vista, we have a committee that meets and reviews the book in its entirety, and they have to take into consideration academic value, and the teacher also submits their lesson plan that went along with the book. Then they make a recommendation to the governing board of our school district, and it's ultimately the governing board's decision whether or not to take it off the shelves.
Now, you're the public information officer for the Sierra Vista Unified School District. You're not on the board or the governing board. Is that to say that this is a big controversy right now on the board?
It's been a bit of a stir in our community, for sure.
All right. So in the crosshairs there in the Sierra Vista Unified School District is Dreaming in Cuban by Cristina Garcia. Now, if the process is successful, finally, the books are physically removed from shelves. And now that's where you come in, Amy Crump, right?
Yes.
Former librarian for the Marshall Public Library in Missouri. Have you ever had to remove a book from the shelves?
I did while I was at the Marshall Public Library. We did make a decision to temporarily remove a book from the shelves.
And you literally go to the shelves, remove it? Where does it go? You burn it? What do you do?
No. The book was just put in a drawer while the board itself met. We were in a unique situation because we did not have a policy that addressed how to make a decision when a book is challenged. So we took both books that were challenged, Blankets by Craig Thompson and Fun Home by Alison Bechtel, and we put them in a drawer while the board formed a committee and we developed a selection policy for the library, and that took about 4 months. At the time that that policy was in place, we then took the books back out of the drawer, applied the policy to those books to see if they should be on the shelves or not, and the decision was made to return them to the shelves.
All right. So to all three of you, how do you feel about this process? First, Amy Crump, as a librarian, removing books from shelves, you feel good about that? Bad about that?
Definitely do not feel good about that. It was a necessary action at that point, as I said, because we did not have a policy in place. Public libraries are in a little bit of a different situation than your other two guests who are representing school libraries that have had challenges, because we are not required to be in loco parentis like the schools. So the responsibility for what children see rests on the parents when it comes to public libraries.
In the school district, Sarah Pacheco, is this process a good one in your view, or does it create a lot of controversy that maybe the board wishes it didn't have to deal with?
I feel that the process is good because we are hearing from a committee of people that it's made up of teachers, administrators that have to take everything into consideration. And both sides are offered the opportunity to speak up. And we have definitely heard from both sides on this issue. Everyone's been allowed to say their part.
Okay.
And ultimately, the decision rests with the governing board.
So, Mike Holtzknecht, democracy in action here, is that what you're feeling? Or does somebody have an opportunity to get really mad and get a book out of the library, and most of the people in the community don't even really know about it?
That's two questions. Democracy, yes, in its finest form. And when our school board and our community got to the point to have the public hearing, as Sarah was discussing, there were over 200 people in the gymnasium. The meeting had to be moved to the gymnasium because there was so much public interest on both sides. And our school board gave the entire community, and in fact, they had a representative from the American Library Association come down from Chicago to speak at our public forum. And that's what democracy is about.
All right. To the three of you, one last question, and then we'll go. What concerns you most? Anti-American language in a book? Potentially profane and pornographic sort of sexual content in a book, or religious blasphemy in a book? Mike, Sarah, and then Amy. Mike?
All of those things to some degree, but on the other hand, none of those things to other degrees. Some of those things, questioning authority, questioning religion to an extent, sometimes that's part of education.
All right. Well, you've thought this through. Sarah Pacheco, how about you? What's the biggest concern? Is it the sexual content, the religious content, or the political content?
I think that religious content and political content is in the eye of the beholder. But for parents, it seems to mostly be sexual content and profane content. That's a pretty clear line that most parents don't want, you know, school districts to follow.
Amy Crump, what about you? The three categories, which concerns you the most?
I don't think any of those three are, as far as the content of a book, are my main concern. My main concern would be about a group of people or an individual trying to make decisions about what an entire community has access to.
So you're more concerned about the censorship than any of the content?
Yes.
All right. Amy Crump, Sarah Pacheco, and Mike Holtzknecht, thank you so much for allowing us to tell this story.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
So what books have been banned at your child's school or library? Do you agree with the decision to ban them? Tell us a story. Weigh in on this conversation. Go to thetakeaway.org and take our book quiz as well. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.